people in one Washington State community could be losing access to their only grocery store if Canadian border restrictions don't let up. Here's Chi Radio's Heather Bosch.
If you want to shop for groceries in Point Roberts,
there are none. It's just me.
Allie Hayden owns the 38,000 square foot international marketplace in a community whose only land border is with Canada, a community so reliant on Canadian business.
We even have two cash register drawers. When we do a transaction, we have two drawers that open, one with U.S. funds, one with Canadian funds.
But the COVID border closure has cut off shoppers in from Canada and prevented Point Roberts residents from getting fresh meat and produce anywhere else. Her store's been a lifeline to the roughly 1,000 residents who live there, one that she's had to subsidize during the pandemic.
Well, I posted a six-figure loss for 2020, first time ever I've posted any kind of a loss. So far in 2021, I would say on average about $30,000 a month.
Hayden says other U.S. communities in a similar situation have been given permission to cross the border because they can't get essentials where they live. She says that puts her in a catch-22. Keep the store open, providing jobs and food for residents who have difficulty traveling, or close it and hope border restrictions ease. She's having to do the latter, setting a July 15th date to close.
I have been subsidizing this for 15 months, and I can't do it anymore.
She says what may be most frustrating, Point Roberts has a high COVID vaccination rate and a very low case count, but the pandemic border closure continues.
Chi Radio's Heather Bosch. Let's go to CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy in Washington, D.C. Stephen, it's pretty clear that the Biden administration wants no part of the defund the police refrain that's popular with some Democrats. And he and the attorney general laid out a vision for fighting violent crime. So what are they planning to do?
Well, Dave, the president, you're absolutely right, yesterday said that this is not the time to turn our backs on law enforcement or our communities, he said. So clearly going out of his way as he announced his administration strategy for combating violent crime, to distance himself from the rhetoric of those in his party who say that it's time to defund police agencies. In fact, the president yesterday pointed to in the COVID rescue package that he says can be used by cities for policing. He specifically talked about the idea of paying officers overtime, hiring new police officers, and even buying new devices that police can use to, for example, detect the sound of gunfire. Mm-hmm. It's all part of the strategy the president and the attorney general laid out yesterday that talked mainly about gun violence. And a key component of it is cracking down on federally licensed firearms dealers that knowingly, the president says, violate the law. He says there are too many rogue dealers in the country that take advantage of the supply they have of firearms. And then the president alleges, sell them to people who are not legally allowed to buy them. The president also said that in addition to this, he believes that Congress should be reinstating the assault weapons ban, or the ban on semi-automatic weapons, that he helped write as a senator in 1994, as he was chairman then of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He authored the crime bill and said in his remarks yesterday that he's got a lot of experience dealing with this.
Of course, the pro-gun side says that horse has left the barn. I mean, you're not going to, even if you started to ban, quote, assault weapons, you have to decide how to define that. There are already so many of them out there. A lot of them are stolen. They're coming in from overseas. I mean, these measures that he announced, are they backed up by some kind of data or study that shows that they would be effective?
Well, no, not necessarily. And the experience of the 1994 assault weapons ban that was in place for 10 years, is used by those who say it's not appropriate to reinstate it. The idea that it didn't prove effective, and that's the reason why it should have been allowed to sunset. The president yesterday essentially mocked those who say that they need to buy or obtain firearms to be prepared to defend themselves against the government. The president yesterday mockingly said that what you really would need are F-15s and nuclear weapons. The Republicans made hay with that last night and into this morning.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's always an entertaining discussion. Does the right to keep and bear, include tanks and bazookas and cannons? I don't think anybody suggested nuclear weapons. Those are pretty expensive anyway. On the infrastructure bill, I hear there's yet, is this a new bipartisan group that is trying to negotiate a compromise, or is this the old one?
Yeah, well, it's a group that's emerged really over the last week or so, a group of 21 senators from both parties who say that they could come to agreement on a package that is, I think, reading between the lines here, in the ballpark of about $1 trillion, more than $500 billion of which would be new spending, which suggests the other roughly 40 to 50% might be moving around money that's already been appropriated or allocated, but would be redirected, and or new revenue streams that are not clear to me at this moment. In fact, all the details are being withheld preceding the president's meeting in about an hour and a half at the White House in the Oval Office behind closed doors with this group of senators who are prepared to present this to him. The White House last night indicated that it was a positive meeting that the senators had with some of the president's most senior aides, including his legislative affairs director, his senior aide Steve Ricchetti, the president's top economic advisor, Brian Deese. They huddled yesterday on Capitol Hill with these senators for hours, saying that they had agreed on a framework. So today it's being presented to the president, the strongest indication yet that there actually is a deal that could wind up passing the Senate. And this is interesting. It's again, a significant development and a key sign that perhaps an infrastructure bill actually could be passed.
Okay,
so this
sounds like progress from the previous group. So does this new group include at least, because they have to have at least 10 Republicans, right? Does it include 10 Republicans?
It does, and that's significant. And the idea here is because you have an even split amongst Republicans and Democrats, that's representative of a broader coalition in the Senate that, you know, the expectation is that it'd be more than 60 senators who would sign on to this in the end. But what's important to note here is that the Democrats in Congress are intent on moving forward on a parallel but separate track with a larger bill that they would aim to pass, if need be, under reconciliation with just 51 Democrats in the Senate. And the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer indicated last night that he sees these two bills, both the bipartisan discussion that we've just been talking about and his own the Democrats' own broader, bigger, more expensive bill, would be codependent. And the idea here is that, you know, as the man who controls the Senate floor, Schumer wouldn't put the bipartisan bill on the floor for passage unless he got a sense that the larger bill, more expensive, more controversial bill, would also be put up for a vote and pass. And so it seems to me that what Schumer is trying to do here is, in a way, box in fellow Democrats like Joe Manchin, who have expressed concern about the size and revenue streams that would be put into a larger infrastructure bill that would talk about more than just physical infrastructure, but human infrastructure, social programs. Manchin has said that he doesn't want to see, for example, the corporate tax raised to 28%, and he also has expressed some skepticism about the size of spending in such a package. So if Schumer is saying you can't have the bipartisan deal, which everyone can agree to, without the harder lift, which is more expensive, it'd be very interesting to see how this plays out. But the fact is that there are important developments today with a meeting, a key meeting at the White House, scheduled for about 90 minutes from now.
Okay, but that would seem to, you know, give away the deal here. So what they would do is get the 10 Republican votes for the parts of the infrastructure that they all agree are infrastructure and pass that, you know, by overriding the filibuster. And then they'd come back with a different bill that is based on the Democratic definition of infrastructure, which Mitch McConnell cannot abide, and pass that on a partisan vote with Kamala Harris casting the tiebreaker. Why would Mitch McConnell allow 10 Republicans to be part of such a deal?
It's a really interesting question. It seems to, underscore the fragility of any potential compromise. And perhaps there's some jujitsu going on here, or an attempt on Schumer's part to play three-dimensional chess with the Republicans to say, aha, see, you're already saying you're willing to agree to this, and you can vote on that, but we're going to move forward without you on a separate track. Would Republicans be willing to say, well, we're not going to support what we all believe we want and can afford because you're going to move forward in a way that we can't stop you? That's an interesting legislative strategy on Schumer's part, if that's what he intends to do. And I think you're right to point it out.
CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy in Washington. Stephen, thank you.
You bet.
time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. A boat captain found a decades-old message in a bottle in Michigan, and with the help of strangers on the internet, she went the extra mile to track down the writer's daughter.
I know the date on the bottle was November 1926, and his birthday was in November, and it wouldn't surprise me if he just did that on his birthday.
During a late evening dive on Friday, the owner of Nautical North Family Adventures, Captain Jennifer Dowker, discovered what turned out to be a 95-year-old artifact. Dowker told CBS affiliate WWTV.
I spotted that green bottle on the top of a fish bed. So I'm like, oh, well, that looks cool. So I reached down and grabbed it and noticed there was paper in it. So immediately I was like, all right, this is great.
The note inside read, "Will the person who finds this bottle give this paper to George Morrow, Sheboygan, Michigan, dated 1926. After it was shared on Facebook, it quickly gained a lot of attention, and eventually Dowker was able to find George's daughter.
It was a total shock, but knowing my dad, he always liked to do little things. Like when we were building our basement, he was putting up the paneling and he put a note behind that.
While she plans to come take a look at the note for herself in September, Michelle Primeau says she would rather have Dowker keep it.
You know, I was really hoping to get it back and I was going to frame it and everything. And then when I went to bed last night, I started thinking about it. And it'll make my dad live on if I give it to Jen.
Well, Dowker says the bottle probably isn't the only interesting artifact in the bottom of the Sheboygan County Marina.
So we found this the last time we washed the windows, and I found this one this time we washed the windows. So there's tons of cool stuff down there.
She just keeps finding treasures down there. What a cool thing, though, to find a 95-year-old message in a bottle.
How about that?
You ever thrown one of those out there or hit
I think I did once, although when I do like little home fix-up projects, I'll sometimes autograph the back of the drywall.
I do the same thing. When we built our deck, we all signed our names on the beams that will likely never be uncovered unless somebody tears up the Trex beams.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's cool to kind of leave a piece of yourself somewhere.
Exactly. Just don't hide any money there because sometimes you forget you did it.
That's true.
And then,
No, when we cleaned out my grandpa's house, I mean, they would find rolls of, because back then, too, the Depression era kids, they all grew up hiding money, stashing money here and there. And, you know, it's not like we found a fortune, like $1 million. But yeah, you had bills and coins tucked everywhere in that house.
And now it's 7:48 from the G and Ursula Show, which you can hear weekdays from 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio. Here is G. Scott. Every year might as well be an election year, and so yesterday we had the president and the attorney general laying out their new emphasis on violent crime. And so I'm curious, were you expecting the Biden administration to make being tough on crime one of their big talking points for the midterm elections?
No, but I'm also upset at myself for not understanding that Joe Biden has been in politics since the Stone Age years, right? So he's been there before. So when you hear him say things like to advance community policing and invest in evidence-based community violence interventions, you're like, oh yeah, that's right. I've seen this movie before.
Yes.
You know, the movie where it's like, hey, we're going to get tough on drugs. It's the war on drugs. Remember that like 50, 60 years ago? How's that going? Remember the war on poverty? How's that going? Here's what I'm tired of. I'm tired of Joe Biden, and I'm tired of the Democrats leading from the back. As a matter of fact, I'm tired of this two-party system that is just going back and forth and absolutely accomplishing nothing. You want to impress me? You want to do something about crime? You want to do something about poverty? You want to do something about that? Then this whole more policing stuff, that's not how you're doing it because you've done this before. Give people free health care. I don't know about you guys, but I just recently saw people getting vaccines across the country. So much so that people are being begged to come get a vaccine. So if people are getting free vaccines across the country, you can't tell me they can't get free insulin across this country. So I know that can happen. Give people education. Give people higher wages. We're still on $7.25 for the last 10 years. That's federal minimum wage.
Hey, and president.
How about this? No, that's not for president. This is just me for common sense. How about we stop letting billionaires pay a less of a tax rate than everybody that's listening to the show right now?
So it's if you were on Tucker Carlson right now, he would say, so you mean to tell me, G. Scott, that if we hand out free insulin, it'll stop carjackings?
I would say, Tucker, well, you and others get paid to drive hate, so I'm not even talking to you. That's number one. Number two, I'm just saying this. Have we not all seen this movie before? But here's what I have learned as we watch this movie. Nothing gets people more riled up than hearing someone say, yeah, we want to stop the crime. Who doesn't want to stop crime? Everybody, nobody, I don't care what side of politics that you're on. I don't know, doesn't care about the color of your skin, where you live. Nobody wants crime. Nobody wants anything to happen to their kids and to their families. But what I don't want to do is start doing the same thing, they call it insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. So this is what I think Joe Biden is doing. Joe Biden is basically saying, okay, that whole defund the police was a terrible message, which it was. I've been saying that before. That was the dumbest slogan ever. But what he's saying is I'm going to have to get some of these votes. 22 elections are coming. We're going to have to start getting on that. So what can we do? Let's just go ahead and do this. Let's get harder on crime. Let's get tougher on crime. Now, here locally in the Seattle area, do I think they need to get a little tougher on crime by quit letting these people in and out of jails? Absolutely. I talk about that on the show all the time.
Well, I heard you yesterday. Yeah, you said the person or people who are throwing rocks at cars.
Attempted murder.
Yes. And I think that, you know, is reasonable. But I think what we've learned, and you know, I've heard you and Dre's, who co-hosts your show sometimes, talk about the program he's involved with, where a lot of these gang members or those prone to violent criminal behavior, they need a helping hand. They need some compassion and a way out rather than punishment.
You know how many, hey, Colleen, I'm glad you brought that up. You know how many times I've, you know, gone back to Chicago and, you know, I ain't gonna lie, I've known some people in my life as far as, you know, they weren't really on the straight. But sure. I get to see them again and I'm like, yo, you look good, man. What you doing? Oh, man, gee, I got a good job, man. I ain't messing that up. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
It's so hard because I think if one of these people committed a crime against my family or my daughters, it would be hard for me to have compassion for them or realize that they were led down this road in certain situations. I'm not saying everybody, you know, shouldn't be punished. There's jails and punishment for a reason. But yeah, the vast majority just need a way out.
No question. And so I just want to just say, like, this whole the war on drugs and this movie that I keep bringing up and saying is I'm saying this. Look, for everybody that is saying, look, why are people this way? Well, let me help you understand. They're this way because there's so many people that just don't have hope. Right. They don't look for the next day tomorrow. They're just looking for the right now. And then when they are in that situation and if they get caught up in this system, it's harder for them to be a parent. Right. It's already hard to be a parent no matter what your financial status is. Imagine being a parent and now you're poor. Imagine being a parent and now your kids can't come to you. I've been there before. I know exactly. I've been a part of that movie. And then when you can't be a good parent because you lack the finances, what's going to happen to those kids? And then when those kids become parents, right, and they're still in the same system, and guess what kind of parents you're going to be? Because it is just a revolving door. So if the passion you guys are hearing in me, the emotion you're hearing, you're just hearing me say, hey, can we just stop playing the same movie over and over again? Can we get politics to just stay away from just culture wars and actually get some productivity done? And so, I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I don't, just the whole party thing just drives me nuts. All right, I'm done.
Okay, I wanted to make sure because it's
done.
Good. So,
sorry, guys.
Tune in 9 o'clock, G. Scott with Ursula. Thanks, G.
All right, guys.
Oh!
And that's time for Choke Points. Street Racing Edition. Cops and prosecutors across King, Pierce, and Snohomish counties have been going after illegal street racing for months now, and their tactics appear to be working. Let's see what they're doing. Let's go back to Chris.
And we've seen the videos of the street racing, I think, around the region here. A lot of the real deal stuff where people are getting hurt and even killed. It's very popular on social media. The videos are all over the place there. And, you know, we see it where the participants or spectators are hurt when a driver loses control as they're spinning donuts and things like that. And it's not the old drag racing that we used to see that's as much of a problem anymore. That's, you know, you line up on the long straight streets of Auburn or Kent. It's the takeover events that have really caught the attention of law enforcement. enforcement. It's something that's really kind of exploded in popularity for drivers over the last decade. And this is where organizers use cars or hundreds of spectators to actually take over and block a road or intersection to keep the people and the police away.
Use spectator vehicles or participant vehicles to block all four entries into that intersection and create basically a big pit where vehicles can do donuts and drift.
State Trooper Chase Van Cleve says these racers have even done it on the freeway, where blockers slow the traffic to a stop so the racers in front of them can do their burnouts with a blockade behind them. This isn't just Seattle or King County either. Racers are going wherever they could find a spot where they think they could avoid the police. Pierce County, Snohomish County, even further out into rural areas. No area seems to be immune right now. In the past, the police would just go into these events, you know, and just try to shut it down and, you know, do what they could to try to stop them. But right now, Trooper Van Cleve says that isn't really safe or actually productive anymore.
We've had, as the state patrol, trooper vehicles that have come into these scenes and they've been surrounded and hit and kicked. You know, we've seen videos of them jumping and kicking cars of people who are just driving through and stuck in this mess.
Now they're trying to stop these events before they get going using the intelligence that they're gathering in this combined emphasis patrol.
We have emphasis groups that go out on the nights of these events and are trying to safely stop them from happening, or, you know, stop the event before it gets to be too big.
And that's where this coordination between the counties, local agencies really comes into play. In the past, once a race was broken up and the people scattered and went elsewhere, the local police would really just kind of focus on where they were, or if the cars all left, they're like, okay, somebody else's jurisdiction, not my problem. Well, now the region as a whole is tracking these events. And as they head from one place to another, they try to follow them, try to figure out where they're going. Their whole goal here is to build enough cases and strong cases to prosecute everybody. And that includes everyone who's at these events.
If you are there in any capacity, you are, in a law enforcement perspective, culpable for the actions that are taking place.
That includes spectators. So far, local prosecutors using this combined emphasis, building cases on several dozen people for more than 380 charges. Things like reckless driving and vehicular assault, things that actually carry some heavy weight. Those cases are against participants, organizers, and yes, even spectators. Trooper Van Cleve says these new tactics are working, but they got a long way to go.
It's not going anywhere. The problem isn't solved. Summer is going to be hot. It's going to be busy. And we, for safety of our communities, want to continue this push into really attacking in the takeover scene and the racing scene head on to keep people safe.
Is there a way to give people like this a place where they can safely do their drag races?
They have, and they do. I mean, there are speedways.
And they still want to take over streets, because the takeover, that just strikes me as outrageous. It used to be once upon a time when skateboarding was sort of considered, you know, counterculture. They were skating on, you know, stairways and public areas. They built skate parks for them, and now it's great. Why can't you do the same with these guys?
Well, they can, but there's a segment of this population that enjoys, that actually enjoys kind of the recklessness and the danger involved in blocking intersections and these takeover events, where just going out and racing doesn't do them for them anymore. They want this kind of high risk adventure, and that's what they're doing. And so I'm not sure if placing them, I mean, maybe instead of at the speedway where you could just run straightaways or whatever. I mean, there are times that there are police cars that are souped up and whatnot, and they're like, hey, come race a cop, and they do it at the speedway where it's safe to do it. You can drag against a cop all you want, safe, whatever, but that doesn't do it for a certain segment of this particular part of the culture. And that takeover is what kind of gets the juices flowing. And that's what has law enforcement so concerned, because it's not just dangerous for them. But so, I mean, say that one that we saw where the person was hurt by Seattle Center, where they took over the intersection by Mopop and the McDonald's there. They were just cutting donuts. You know, the car went out, hit just people. And sometimes they're hitting just people walking on the street who aren't even there, weren't even aware of this. And so, yeah, they've got to try to find some way to get after this. And they're trying. But they move. Their cars are mobile. When they know the cops are onto them, they move someplace else. So, but yeah, I mean, maybe if you set up a pit somewhere where they could go do this in a wide open spot in a parking lot, maybe that would attract some. I don't know, but there's
something
to
kind of the
danger.
Do you know how the people who pulled off the Seattle Center thing were punished?
Most of them got away, except for the people that
got
were
away.
Injured. Yeah.
Well, isn't that why they opened skate parks? Because the skaters were all over, and so
exactly.
They opened skate parks, so the skaters had somewhere to go. So let's open some drag racing areas.
Yeah, but Chris is saying that's not risky enough for them. They want to actually engage.
Yeah, I mean, because obviously we still see people skateboarding in places where they shouldn't, even though there are skate parks.
Yeah, but not as much as they used to.
True, but this segment of the population, from what I'm hearing, doesn't get their juices flowing by doing something as controlled as that.
Let's ask them. I've never asked them. Would it, there's still a risk. You're still driving really fast, and there's people all around you.
Yeah,
I mean,
don't worry. You can still kill yourself if you do it.
They want to go through the risk, at least they're not endangering the rest of us.
The thing is, this is how the police end up getting militarized, because it's unacceptable to close a public right of way. I don't care what it's for. If you want to march in the street, you get a permit. But if you want to, drag race and put people at risk, I'm sorry. That's when you crack down. You surround them. You round them all up. You throw them in jail. And you take away their right to ever own a car again.
Well,
I don't see how you tolerate that.
Well, let's not forget, we also saw this during the protests last summer, where the tactics were to use a bunch of cars to stop in the middle of the freeway, then everybody
also
would get out.
And it's dangerous, as we know, because of what happened.
Yeah, so there's a lot of prongs to this thing, but yeah, I mean, it's one of the issues that that's why they're working on it, and they're building cases. I mean, 384 charges, a lot of them with heavy weight, felony stuff. Maybe that'll send the message.
Yeah.
That this isn't going to be tolerated anymore.
As long as I'm ranting, why can't you have some rule where if somebody passes you on, let's say I-90 has happened the other day at about, I don't know, 85 miles an hour in a BMW, that there's a penalty for that, too?
Well, if you get caught, that would be a speeding ticket and most likely reckless driving.
You can't catch him because he's going so fast.
Well, welcome to the world of the state patrol. It's difficult to catch those things, through an urban core. It's very difficult to do what they're doing.
We can have two freeway systems. Enter the one if you wish to die. Enter the other if you wish to drive
slow and
safe.
I like that idea.
If we had an Autobahn, I'd be in that thing all day.
Of course you would. And also, you know, sometimes they close off the center lane for these bicycle things.
Mm-hmm.
Just close it off one weekend and let people go screaming down.
Sure.
You'd probably have to close the whole bridge. Heck, we closed the whole bridge for the Blue Angels. We
get
could
it
do
out of
that
your
maybe once a year.
Year.
Right.
Yeah.
Get it out of your system.
I would do it. I
By
love
the way,
yourself
I
the
honestly
water.
Think no, I was a race car time. Driver in my past life. I really do.
Or you're a speed demon too?
No,
is that
no.
You?
No. Everything changed when I had kids because I could not imagine endangering them.
There's
by
another thing.
My
Make
own
some of these people
driving.
Get married and have kids.
Well, you just have to play mind tricks. Just tell yourself your kid is in the other car as you're tempted to speed. But it doesn't mean that I wouldn't want to go to Vegas and go, you know, drive a Lamborghini on one of their tracks that's set aside for those purposes. Oh, it feels so good.
Of course.
By the way, from the 360 on the state roofing text line, I used to drag race on the street. Then I spent 20 days in jail. Now I take it to the track.
There you go. See? We have rational people listening to this broadcast.
You can ring my bell, Rachel Bell.
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien along with Chris Sullivan. Rachel Bell is here to talk jargon. So let's circle back, Rachel, and wish you well on your future endeavors and all the other jargon that I absolutely detest. What is this about?
That is some blue sky thinking, Colleen. I really respect that.
I'm a self-starter. What can I say?
There's an article in the Seattle Times this morning that said Washington is the country's worst offender when it comes to using too much corporate jargon. And I'm sure a lot of people listening right now who work at the big corporate tech companies are nodding their heads and rolling their eyes and agreeing. So there was a recent analysis of 6.3 million online job descriptions posted in the U.S., the U.K., Canada, and Australia. It was published, it was done by the publishing tool Canva. And they looked at 40 commonly used phrases like team player, core competency, and take it to the next level, and things like granulation, growth hacking, blue sky thinking. And they found that Washington employers used more jargon in their job ads than any other state in the country. So for every 1,000 job ads placed in our state, 593 of them contained, like they said, code-like acronyms, technical babble, business buzzwords that are understood by a lot of people in the industry, but also detested. So there were only two other states that came close that were in the 500 range, and that was California and Massachusetts. And they said that this showed up most in information technology, marketing, finance and business, HR, and media, which I was surprised about because I've never encountered jargon ever. And so I don't understand what any of it means. But whenever I hear my friends, you know, at those big companies talking about it, I feel for them. So yeah. There is an expert that they consulted, Michael Hanford. He's a professor of applied linguistics at Cardiff University. And he said, you know, jargon is good if you're using it to describe a job. So, for example, applicant must have expertise in corpus linguistics and be fluent in R, because then people who know that job know what it means and they know the skills that they need to have that job. It is when it's the business cliches like laser focus, think outside the box, thought shower, peel the onion.
Thought shower.
I've never heard of any of these. That's when people don't like it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this sounds familiar and you get stuck in that because now as a hiring manager, you know, I'm in charge of looking over our job descriptions and hiring attributes and all of that. And I'm on a mission to cut down, especially in our news scripts too, because I've always be conversational, don't use cop talk, all of that. So in our hiring papers, I wanted to make sure I cut down on that as well because I feel like it's cliche.
It makes sense that this happened because, you know, language is something that is ever evolving. There's all kinds of new language that comes every single year, you know, the dictionary introduces new words. And mm-hmm. So the tech field is so big, it makes sense that they would have their own language. But it seems like a lot of people who work in those industries don't like it either. It's funny for what we do. I don't think of it as jargon, but, you know, we have different names for things that we do. And almost every time I get an email from a listener asking about a story I did, they always call it a spot. I heard your spot on Tom and Curly. I heard your spot on Seattle's Morning News. And that is not what we call a story. And I can sense that they're trying to use our industry jargon. And I'm so curious where people heard that word because they write it every time. So if you're listening, a spot in our industry is what we call a commercial.
Right.
If I am going to record a commercial that's going to air, I'll say, I'm going to cut a spot. So right. I just want to know if there was like an old TV show that called them spots and people are trying to copy it and be cool. A lot of the states, the most popular is make hay.
Make hay of it. Yeah.
And then there's move the needle, low hanging fruit.
Did you see North Carolina? Let's open the kimono. What? I had to Google that. Apparently that means like reveal. Let's see. What does it say? What is it? Open kimono means to reveal what is being planned or to share important information freely. I don't know if I'd feel comfortable if a boss came up to me and said, hey, let's open the kimono.
I had a boss in another market who was notoriously hated. And we loved to make fun of all of his jargon that it seemed like he made up. And one of the things he would always ask when you presented a story, should we put the story on the air? He would say, does it resonate in the cul-de-sac? He said this all the time. Does it resonate in the cul-de-sac? And to this day, you know, that job, I think, was like 16, 17 years ago. My friends and I from all over the country where we've since scattered in radio text each other. Does it resonate in the cul-de-sac?
I still use some jargon, but at least I know when I'm saying it, I'm giving a wink, wink, nod, nod, right? Like people know I'm making fun of myself using it. If I could eliminate one corporate jargon that if I could choose any, I would say, wish you well on your future endeavors.
Like when they fire you?
Yeah. It's like the most backhanded, and it's in every exit email. So can we just say like, be creative. Au revoir. We bid them adieu. Like, do you really wish them well on their future endeavors if you fired them?
Mm-mm. Yeah, I think the one that I don't like, but this is old school because this was even in Office Space, is the, can I borrow you? I just can't stand that. Can I borrow you for a minute? And I'm saying it in like a lady's
voice. It's never a minute.
But it was a man who did it to me most at Cairo.
Right. Well, and it's never a minute either, is it?
No, it isn't. And it just feels like something bad is going to happen. So if you're listening, we want to know what your least favorite corporate jargon is, or the most ridiculous one that we cannot figure out. We'll have to Google. You can use the text line 98973. Let us know what corporate jargon you can't stand.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
I don't know how you management types do it. All that running stuff up the flagpole and borrowing. And
it's those fat paychecks that keep us saying those things.
That's right. I forgot about that. You're richly rewarded for coming up with those clichés.
We're paid every time we say self-starter and circle back.
Yes.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.